You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 106.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone, to another Local Maximum. We have a co-hosted show today with Aaron. Aaron, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well.
All right, we have a pretty good quick show. Well, I don't know how quick it's going to be. It's always famous first words, I guess. Yeah. We're good at keeping it to an hour, I think, but we're usually not good at keeping it to 30 minutes, which I think works out. So we're going to talk about mapping technology today, geotechnology, which, as you know, Aaron, is something that I've been working on for a really long time. So that's always a good thing to talk about. It's the 15th anniversary of Google Maps. There's been an article about that and a lot of thought about that. We'll talk about that a little bit. A few other stories. There's an update from Venezuela that I find interesting. Neither of us are an expert on Venezuela, but I am always interested in seeing what's happening to those closed off countries and, you know, how the process of opening them up works or not opening up. You know, we'll see what happens. A few quick news stories today that we're going to go through. Ready, Aaron?
Ready. Let's hit it.
All right. In cryptocurrency news, Bitcoin has surpassed $10,000 for one unit for the first time this year. It actually feels like the whole crypto market has been up this year. The market I've been following for a long time, it always feels like, you know, the market is doing badly, but then it always ends up, you know, because at the beginning of last year, it sank all the way down to the 3,000s from 20,000. People are like, oh, this is really bad. And it was swimming at the bottom for a long time in 2019. Then in the middle of 2019, it shot all the way up to like 14,000. And people were excited for like a few weeks, but then it started slowly falling down to 6,000 again. So for the majority of the time, you always think you're losing, but now it looks like it's going up to 10. And also, something that's different this time than it has been for the last couple years, since 2017, basically, when we had that altcoin craze, which are other cryptocurrencies besides Bitcoin. Since then, Bitcoin has gained in value as compared to the other currencies. So Bitcoin topped out at around 70% of the cryptocurrency market. Now the other coins, such as Ethereum, are starting to go up relative to Bitcoin. So it might be an alt season. I feel like there are the four seasons of cryptocurrency. There's crypto winter. There's Bitcoin spring, there's alt season, and there's moon harvest. And so we might be entering alt season right now.
Well, so when you say that some of the alts are up, I guess my question is this a rising tide lifts all boats situation where Bitcoin is, as you said, they broke over 10K, but they're also, we're seeing greater gains elsewhere, or is it a zero-sum game is oversimplifying, but does somebody have to be losing out for the altcoins to be gaining here?
No, right. So for the last year and a half, basically, when Bitcoin dropped, the other ones dropped even more. And then when Bitcoin went up, the other ones went up, but not as much. So the ratio that they had to Bitcoin fell. Now that ratio is starting to go back up. And the ratio is something, I mean, there's some controversy over, not controversy, but people kind of debate online whether the ratio matters. I think it matters because it sort of shows how dominant Bitcoin is in this space relative to the alternatives. And I don't think it's a winner-take-all space, but I do think it's a winner-take-most space, and that winner is going to be Bitcoin. But there's a huge question as to what the role of these other cryptocurrencies are going to play. And if you see the tide turn on at least some of them, the big ones right now, you know, they have real lasting power, so it appears.
So if we are entering an alt season, how do we as individuals benefit from this without exposing ourselves to the risks of crypto winter?
Well, usually, so I would say we had a crypto winter in 2018 when everything was falling. A Bitcoin spring was 2019 where Bitcoin was going up, but the alts weren't doing anything. Now, alt season is really a good season for, I think everything just starts to rise. I would compare it to 2016 was the last time we had an alt season. I don't know what individuals can do. I think if you're in the crypto space, the crypto space is volatile enough as it is. So you really just want to go, if you want to invest in it, you really just want to go to the big guys, Bitcoin, and then maybe like look at the top 10 on coinmarketcap.com. If you happen to want to bet on a long shot and some of these new coins that come out, most of them are duds. They go to zero, but some of them can give really high rates of return, and I really have no good advice on that. I haven't really been into doing that at all. The way I see it is, the story from Bitcoin, Ethereum, some of the Bitcoin forks like Bitcoin Cash, those are really interesting. But when you get down to the bottom, it starts looking like moonshots, and the technology is already like all the technological innovation is going to be on top of the big guys, in my opinion.
Well, there's a dangerous attraction to the big risk, big reward opportunities, much like you mentioned in gaming strategies for Guess Who in your previous episode.
Right. So, betting on Bitcoin is like a good, does your person wear glasses? But betting on the 100th, the altcoin in 100th place is like asking a question in Guess Who, where only one person fits that description, possibly zero. And so it's probably not a good idea. Okay, so moving on, a lot of political news in the last couple of weeks. If this were back in the Max and the Wiz days, back when I was at Yale, we would always be talking about the political news, especially during an election year. Maybe I'll start doing it again here. But I've just been glued to the TV. I haven't been glued to the TV because I canceled cable. I'm a cord cutter now. But I've been glued to YouTube Live and all these other things because, man, we had that State of the Union, which was hilarious. The Democratic primaries, also hilarious. And impeachment is done, which was not hilarious. That was kind of boring. Yeah, I know. Who knows? They might bring it back.
Impeachment too, the Boogaloo?
Yeah. I have been trying to bet on things to try to predict.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask if the primary results have yielded any major shifts there that you've been able to take advantage of.
Yes. So I definitely made money on shorting Elizabeth Warren. She's almost down to, 2 cents from a high of like 40 cents. Yeah. So I'm going to cash out on that. Sadly, I also made money shorting Andrew Yang because I liked the guy, but I just didn't think he had an 8% chance of winning, and now he dropped out, so I made a little bit on that. I got into Tulsi Gabbard on the plus side many months ago when she was like a 2 cents, and I meant to cash out when she was at 5, and I totally forgot to do that, so I lost money on that. I have, for some reason, unpredicted, Tom Steyer is at 11% to win the South Carolina primary. I shorted the crap out of that. There's no way that guy's going to win that. So hopefully I'll make a few bucks on that one.
Is that one that Bloomberg is in the running for, or does he not show up until Super Tuesday?
Yeah, he does not show up until Super Tuesday. Oh, wow. So it's Biden and Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders are also going to be in that. But I don't think that Tom Steyer is going to beat any of those three.
It seems unlikely, given, not that past performance is an indicator of future expectations, but seems unlikely.
He's putting a lot of money into it, but there's no one there. There's nothing that I don't see any reason for anyone there to vote for him, but we'll see.
Well, my hope is that he is one of several millionaires who put a lot of money into this election and are functionally just lighting it on fire and getting nothing for their expenditures.
That's a probably a good lesson for people, that a lot of this money is just wasted money. Did anything?
Unfortunately, the only people that benefit from it are in media and maybe some political strategists. But
yep. I mean, a lot of people getting that Bloomberg money. I know that. all right. Let's. Well, did anything subvert your expectations in the primary season?
I'm surprised by how poorly Biden is doing, but not really. So
yeah,
I don't know that there's more to say on that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll move on. I mean, it's looks like Bernie Sanders is going to be the front runner, and this is going to be a lot of fun. I can't see him getting a majority of the delegates, and so that would mean. But we'll see. Maybe he will.
Yeah. Well, I
didn't think Trump would either.
I haven't looked on Metaculus yet, but I would expect they should have a prediction on whether or not it will be whether or not the Democratic nominee will be elected on the first ballot, or if it's going to go to a brokered convention.
Yeah,
because as an observer, that would be the most exciting thing. But I think it's probably looking at, you know, a less than 30% chance of that scenario occurring at this point.
Yeah, I just look at this and, man, it looks good for Donald Trump here. I don't see any of these people doing well toe to toe against them. Sure, maybe in a poll like, hey, do you vote for Donald Trump or do you vote for a generic Democratic candidate? Generic Democratic candidate might win. But the problem is it's going to be one of these people.
Well, keep in mind, it's February, so we've got, what, 9-10 months more of this before the
Oh, this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, so a lot can change between here and now. Think of all the different countries we could go to war with between now and then.
Oh, yeah, that's true. All right, on that note, let's move on. We're going to talk about Google Maps for a second. But first of all, speaking of Google Maps, there's this news story that came out. Google says it accidentally sent some users' private videos to strangers. What does that mean? It means, so Google, do you use Google Photos at all?
I do, yes.
Yeah, I do too. I have it. It uploads photos from my phone and also uploads from my desktop. Sometimes it uploads photos. It finds photos on my desktop that I didn't even know I had that aren't really mine, and it also puts those in there too. And so Google... Apparently, there's Google Takeout where you could download all your old content. And apparently, some people asked for their content back and they got random other people's videos.
And yeah, so, this seems a little problematic.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. I mean, these cloud services are clearly not that safe. We're all trusting them. It's not like it's... I don't know if you're doing the same as me. I'm like, oh, this is definitely not safe. And then I go dumpty dumpty dum, and then I put everything on there. And then it, and then I'm just like, what did I just do? I'll just leave it there. I'll figure out what to do. I'll be a safety nut later on. It's horrible.
The convenience factor still outweighs my paranoia at this point. Whether it should or not is an open question. But my yeah. actions prove that it currently does.
So the question is, did they get the wrong user ID, or did they download their entire photo set, or did it just get a few videos?
It sounds
the article wasn't very clear.
Not entirely clear, but the way I think I'm supposed to interpret it is that if I go to Google Takeout, I'll get most or all of my stuff, but there might be some other random not my photos, not my videos mixed in there, which makes it more complicated, more confusing exactly how this is happening. But at least from what we've read, they haven't been super transparent about the detailed nature of the flaw.
Let me tell you something. These kind of bugs creep into the software that I build all the time. But the difference is I'm building software with like 2 to 5 people. Okay. I think at some place like Google, it's that big. And we know that they're security first on a lot of things. Why wouldn't they be security first on this? I'm sure they're security first in terms of like their own data and like, you know, company secrets. I feel like I see this a lot in consumer applications where they seem to want to do it on the cheap. Even a company basking in money.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're not doing it. Maybe they're not spending cheap, but they're not like, you know, they're not building it on a very good foundation is what I can surmise. I don't want to, you know,
I'm initially only thought that maybe the issue here was that when you were requesting your Google takeout, that it was being sent to the wrong person, in which case you could potentially fix that by having, an encryption key sent to the account of the person who's requesting it. And so if they need that key along with the actual data download to unlock it, but it sounds like we're dealing with content intermixed into whatever this download is. And so that really wouldn't correct the issue there.
Yeah, more and more when I look at these things and I learn about encryption, I start to come to the conclusion that people need to be managing keys and encrypting and decrypting on their end. That doesn't mean everybody has to understand it. But if you have sort of an architecture where, what did we talk about when there'd be like encryption banks, like banks that would hold your keys for you in case you needed a backup of them or something, just so that the average person is not liable to lose them. Did we talk about that in a previous episode?
I don't know if we did, but I did watch the Naomi Brockwell clip that you shared in a previous episode.
Yeah.
The talking about good, security hygiene, and one of the things they talked about was not keeping your passwords. How to properly store your passwords, and they even mentioned the possibility of it's okay to write them down and store them in a secure physical location, like a safe or a safety deposit box. I don't think that was their recommendation, but they're saying that's not as bad as some people have led you to believe.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, don't write them down because you might not want to write them down and leave them in an open office, but if you leave them locked in your house and you're safe, it might be okay. But then, I don't know, now where, if everybody has this very valuable information in their home, I don't know what the right answer is. Maybe the answer is to split these things up and just have some scheme where there's backups and redundancies, and maybe not everyone has to understand it, but everybody has to have a procedure that they go through that someone else makes sure. I'm not sure. I think that how much do people really care about their photos is a good question. I mean, they care about having access to them, but do they care about someone else getting them? I'm sure some people care a lot.
Remember the iCloud hacks that had all those people, including celebrities, private photos that were leaked or hacked or whatever the proper term is for what happened there. I mean, this could easily have been just as bad.
I'm sure they were furious. It sounds like furious, but it probably helped their careers.
Well, yeah, it sounds like this Google takeout issue wasn't actively exploited. That it wasn't a vulnerability being targeted. That it happened to some people by accident.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. That happens.
But that could also just be their spin on it. I mean, we haven't heard anything one way or the other on that.
Yeah, I mean, but that also happens. There's, you know, there, it's improperly tested software. When you push something out to hundreds of millions of people, I mean, there's different standards that I would put into writing software than when, like, what I'm working on now with Foursquare Labs. So it's
and it's not clear if this was they made an update to takeout or something refreshed on the back end server that tied into this. How long was this vulnerability present? There's a lot of unanswered questions there, but they are telling us that it's been fixed and don't worry.
Right. Okay. So on to the good side of Google, or at least the what we're talking about, Google Maps, something that has, I think, positively affected our lives. Google Maps is 15 years old, which to me it's hard to believe 15 years, because that means that it came out, what, at the beginning of 2015?
And they had their. I was going to ask, how old is Sticky Maps?
Sticky Map,
or Sticky
which
Map.
Was
is it
my
Maps
site
Map?
at Yale. Came out and it was based on Google Maps API. I started working on it in late 2015. So they launched their API probably like a year after they launched the mapping service.
Very cool.
Yeah. And Man, do you remember pre-Google Maps? You had MapQuest, right?
Yep.
And rather than what you would have to do is you go and dial up and you'd have MapQuest and you'd look on the map. And then if you wanted to scroll up, you'd press the up button and it'd have to reload the whole thing. And then you'd wait a minute and it would move an inch up. Yep. But they did have pretty good directions that you could print out, beforehand. And then you'd like stick them in, you'd print out like two pages of directions and then you'd stick them like in the sleeve of a physical roadmap. You ever do that?
Yep.
Yeah. I remember those days. Okay. Well, those days are no longer. They haven't, I don't think anyone's been doing that for a good 10 years or so. But it's amazing how far we've come with Google Maps. Although I could talk about what's happened in the last five years because I don't think it's been as big of a change. Let's see, what else can we talk about in the history? The satellite imagery. I mean, there was Google Earth. That was a big deal.
Well, which I think still technically exists, but the differentiation between Google Maps and Google Earth has degraded somewhat.
Oh, sure. They also say in this particular article, which is from Jen Fitzpatrick, who I believe is like the product manager on Google Maps. Let me actually say a senior vice president, Google Maps, which I'm sure maybe is a little like the product manager. I don't know. But okay. So she wrote, here's one quote that I'm going to say. In a world before smartphones, one of the biggest questions that we agonized over was where to put the print button on the page so that people could easily take their directions on the go. I remember one time I visited Google headquarters, maybe it was in 2006. So Google Maps is only like 2 years old. And this is probably when I was interviewing there back in when I was an undergrad. And I met with some people I saw a video about Google Maps and how they loved working on it and all these people were using it and how they caused this bug to make people go round and round in a circle. And then people made memes about it. And sort of like those mid-2000s, like little animations that, you know, people would make up, like, I'm going to go right, then I'm going to go left, then I'm going to go right, then I'm going to go left, you know, that kind of GIF type of a thing. lots of Google Maps memes. But when it came out, it was in Google style, just like they did with search, it was a better product, I think, than the other mapping applications that were out there. It's interesting. There's a Google approach to products. There's an Apple approach to products. Sometimes the Apple approach blows everything away. When it came to maps and when it came to search, the Google way kind of blew away the competition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they're very good at these big data type of projects, which maps,
and Apple
if
maps
anything,
is
data.
Is playing catch up to that now. And it sounds like to some extent they've closed the gap. But
a little bit,
but only in a also played context. And Apple has, I think a lot of there's still some sour taste in people's mouths from the Apple Maps fiasco. What was it? Maybe 5 years ago when they rolled out a version that was just non-functional.
When it rolled out, it wasn't non-functional. It just wasn't as good as advertised. And it was, you'd use it and you'd be like, okay, this is clearly worse than Google Maps. I still think there are some things in Apple Maps that are a little bit worse than Google Maps, particularly if you're driving with it. Google Maps tends to be a lot better. But Apple does have that benefit that they're native to their device. So there are certain seamless things that they can do. But still, Google wins out in my book, even though I still use Apple for certain things. Okay, so what else can we say about it? What have they done the last 5 years? They spent the last 5 years copying Foursquare, essentially. they took a lot of our employees to do it, too. Let's see. So, right, they were talking about exploring the world once you get there. I'm like, yeah, you bit us off, didn't you? This is all the stuff that Google built from 2015 to 2020. I feel is the stuff Foursquare built from 2010 to 2015.
To some extent, they're doing in their Google Maps ecosystem. They built an API, and then they're finding all the the best things built with that API.
Before you get into that, I should point out, it's all about like points of interest and finding that best coffee shop, finding that best restaurant, finding the best place to go with your friends. That's what we worked on at Foursquare. And so Google decided to catch up on that, and they used some of our ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, so they built this API. They let people go off and do cool things with it, and then they decided to take the coolest things they saw there and say, okay, we're going to fold that into our main product, and now it's ours, and we're going to do it better than you could because you don't, you know, through the API, you don't have access to all of the kind of power features that we do from inside the tool, much like Amazon has done with a lot of things in their marketplace. They let other people go off and figure out what products are selling well and are successful, and then they release an Amazon version of it and they promote it internally. And it may even be manufactured in the same factory, just with an Amazon logo on it now. But they can outsell and drive out of the market the people who basically built the opportunity there because they own the platform.
Man, that's a good strategy there.
It's nice work if you can get it.
Yeah. So it's interesting, though. One of the things that's been pointed out to me a lot, and you know, this is one of the first things I covered on the Local Maximum when I interviewed Stephanie Yang in episode 3 about how we do the Foursquare ratings of different venues. It still is more trusted by the people who use it than the ratings in Google. And there are people who swear by the ratings at Foursquare that we built. I don't know anyone who, like, they kind of use the Google ratings because it's there, but I don't know anyone who, like, swears by the Google ratings. And so are the kind of the love that we put in to our ratings products and some of our recommendations products, even after essentially being static for a few years because the company has put investments elsewhere, still is beloved by the users.
Yeah, I think the Google star rating is not a huge indicator that other company whose name begins with a Y tends to carry more weight than Google does in that aspect, even though they have their own fiascos with ratings, at least in the past.
So another thing they've done that's very interesting, particularly has picked up in the last 5 years, is rerouting people through traffic and much more comprehensive traffic data. I mean, it's all about gathering that data. And so
started doing that before the Waze acquisition, but that was a big piece of that capability, yeah. I think.
When was the Waze acquisition again?
Oh, gosh, it's got to be a few years back now, because I want to say they were an Israeli company originally.
They are, yeah. The Waze acquisition was, let me see if I can look this up, acquired by Google.
Looks like 2013.
Okay, yeah, so about 7 years ago now. So they've been rolling that out ever since. I love this article that's been going around about traffic recently. That a man in Berlin creates a traffic jam on Google Maps by wheelbarrowing 99 phones with active Google Maps on it, directions on it. He just wheelbarrowed it through the street he wanted to cross, and all the cars were rerouted away from that street.
Yeah, and apparently this was some sort of some performance art piece.
Yeah. Oh, I said man in Berlin. He's not a man, apparently. He's a YouTuber.
They're a distinct subspecies.
Yeah, exactly. Just like podcasters,
they can interbreed, but it's distinct from standard man on the street.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Interesting quote. Another quote about what's been happening, because a lot of stuff in Maps has been happening under the hood, and so it's kind of interesting to read that. Here's another one. That she wrote, we worked with our data operations team to manually trace common building outlines, then trained our machine learning models to recognize building edges and shapes. Thanks to this technique, we've mapped as many buildings in the last year as we did in the previous 10. Elsewhere, machine learning helps us recognize handwritten building numbers that would be hard even for the passerby in the car to see. This is especially important when mapping areas where formal street signs and house numbers are uncommon. So this, to me, sounds like a precursor to augmented reality, where they're really laying the stage for this. And it's amazing how much I feel like we've been laying the foundation for augmented reality for like 10 years, but it's amazing how much foundation you really need for something like this to work. But I've been seeing a lot in like in research at universities, I've been seeing a lot of interest in this whole, you know, hold your phone up to something and identify to what it is. And so I think that's a very interesting data point.
Yeah, I think they're going to run into some issues with that, much like they did with touch screens, nobody wants to use a Minority Report gesture interface because it involves you holding your hands up in front of you all the time and it just becomes unwieldy.
Sure.
But they are going to find a way to use this augmented reality stuff and make it applicable.
Yeah. But, and by the way, all of these buildings and street numbers and stuff, it doesn't just have to be used in AR. They're using it now for navigation and pictures and 3D models. And
yeah, I don't know if I've mentioned this
street
before.
Numbers for geocoding.
Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned this before in our discussion of particularly of traffic routing, but my impression is that currently it uses, you know, what looks like known traffic loads, and it will try and route you around existing traffic jams. However, I don't believe they do any load balancing in the sense that, you know, we have, you know, 100 people that are trying to get to this the following destination. Do we send them all on the same optimal path, or do we break them up into three groups and send them on three roughly equal paths in optimality to spread that out so that we don't create a traffic jam with our own routing, causing the need to, you know, dynamically reroute partway through? I don't know if any of that is being done or even investigated, but that would seem like an interesting problem to try and tackle.
I could see a future, and it's definitely a long-term future, not a short-term future, where, you know, maybe the roads are charged per use, but you don't have to stop. You know, it's just it's kind of tracked where everyone is, so you can pay, and then you have a program in the car that says, you know, minimize my cost. And so
been talk in a couple of states of implementing mileage taxes, which it's a little bit simpler than that, but, you know, basically your car phones home on a regular basis and says, I've driven X number of miles, and then they send you a tax bill based on that.
Well, the problem with that is it ignores supply and demand. That's more like just central planning of,
right,
you know, of, right, of a tax bill.
You'd be looking for something more like demand-based tolling.
More like private road tolling.
But who will build the roads?
Yeah, we'll probably see it in Liberland before anything else, even though they have no roads yet. Okay, so let's look at, there was one thing that you wrote here that I found interesting. You wrote about, we have traded the serendipity of getting lost or exploring new neighborhoods for recommender apps. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about that, because that was very interesting to me.
Yeah, so It used to be that you had a, you know, you could use a map for the big stuff. Like, I know I'm going to take this interstate to this you know, local route to this state road, and that'll get me from Boston to a particular town in Connecticut. But you probably didn't plan out your route to involve all of the local roads and every last turn in the town, especially if you just needed to get to town and then, you know, I want to figure out a place to eat when I get there. Whereas today, you can go on and look, say, okay, I'm going to be going to the town of Fairfield, and what's the best pizza place in Fairfield, and give me directions exactly to there. And so it takes your head out of kind of on a swivel mode where you're looking around, kind of trying to explore the area around you, and puts you back into the car looking at your directions and focused on how do I get to from point A to point B, which has already been predefined. And the upside is that odds are pretty good you're going to end up at a good pizza place in that town. But you don't know what you might be missing by being in more of an explore and discover mode.
Yeah,
you got to accept though that you might have some bad experiences that come along with that as a result.
Right. So in episode 49, that was a little more than a year ago, when I spoke to Daniela Crescia about like happy maps and you know, not always going the direct route,
optimizing for experience as opposed to efficiency, perhaps.
Yeah, or just not optimizing at all is the way I see it, which is sometimes a very good thing. Adding a little randomization in there is sort of better for human happiness and flourishing. And so, look, we tried to build some of that into the Foursquare apps. I've had a lot of success, you know, showing up at a city with no, you know, with no ideas of what I'm going to do, firing up the Foursquare app, and then kind of doing a combination of looking around and looking at the app to make sure I don't miss anything good or see something good or walk down the right street. But there are many right streets. So it's sort of, there's sort of a back and forth, like an aid. Hey, this can help me. So I'm not, because look, it's not going to be fun if you get completely lost for 2 hours and all you find are warehouses.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I found that even for routes that I more or less know, routes that I've driven before, I'll still turn on the GPS and tell it to direct me to where I'm going, even though I don't really need it. And in some ways, I feel like it can almost become more of a distraction because I'm paying attention to the GPS and less attention to the driving.
Yeah, I feel that way too sometimes. Especially when the GPS is on the phone and the phone is like plugged in and there's no good place to put it. But I don't know, maybe I'm just getting like really crappy zip cars. okay, so Apple Maps, they came out with the redesign. Like you said, it looks like they're always playing catch up with Google Maps. They're kind of perpetual. Their two examples are sharing your estimated time of arrival and also looking around, which essentially means if you're on the map, you can get pictures of the buildings nearby, which sounds very similar to Street View, but it's I'm sure there's a little something more to it than that.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like there. None of these features sound like a Google Maps killer, nor do they sound like something especially unique. But they're things that I guess Apple Maps didn't have before, and so they
might make your life easier once or twice. Yeah. It's interesting. Like one of the things that one time I was in the car with a friend, and he was trying to use the Google, the Google Voice Assistant to help us. And he said, like, you know, hey, Google. I'm sorry, I turned on everyone's Google device just now. He said, hey, Google, try to stop us at the nearest gas station. We need gas. You can't do that. Google doesn't understand that. And as far as I know, Google still doesn't understand that. So there are very simple things that would really make your life a lot easier when you're traveling that, it doesn't even understand that you're going in this direction and you need something that way. You know what I mean? There are a lot of very simple things that I think they could put in that would make everyone's life a little easier.
I haven't tried that recently with Google Maps. It might be better at that now. I think Waze may be able to take voice commands like that. But again, I haven't tested it recently. I will tell you that my current pet peeve with the Google Assistant is that I will tell it in the car to call my wife's cell phone, and it will tell me that it doesn't have a number for my wife's cell phone. But if I tell it, call my wife, it'll say, okay, calling your wife's mobile phone. And so apparently it can't make the connection that a cell phone and a mobile phone are the same thing. And I must have told it at some point that it was a mobile number, not a cell number.
You know, so the thing is, you don't need AI. You don't need real AI to solve any of that. All you need is a few people looking at queries and drawing connections and making some rules, and that would solve it. And you know what? A lot of these problems, I bet there are tons and tons of engineers at Google that want to write these features and probably have written these features. The problem is there's kind of like there's a bottleneck to actually figuring out what goes in the app, and they don't want to overcomplicate things. And also, there's probably this calculation where if we invest more in Google Maps, is that going to get us, or invest in these things, is that going to get us more Google Maps users? And eventually they realize that the answer is no. at the cost of like being an innovative company. That happens all the time. So that's sort of the way I see things. Hey, maybe it's an opportunity. Well, look, I don't think it's an opportunity for someone to come in and make a business around those types of queries, because if they're successful, Google will just copy them. It's more of a feature than a business. But it's good that Google has some competition from Apple and other places, because that's the only thing that will, light a stick of dynamite under them and get them going.
You hear less and less about it now, but for a good 5, maybe 10 year span, building up your company and then being acquired by Google was kind of the dream.
Yeah, that was, well, I've heard, look, I mean, Foursquare's history was Dennis Crowley started Dodgeball, got bought by Google. They shut it down, so he started Foursquare. So I don't really have, the stories I hear about getting acquired by Google are not very positive stories, but some people have.
Yeah, the life after that may not be so promising, but usually you envision the being bought by Google comes with a big cash out.
Yeah, that could happen too. I'm sure that happened with Waze and other places as well. Okay, last thing
at least for somebody
location.
At the top.
Yeah. Last thing on location, again from Apple. Why your iPhone keeps asking about background location use. I mean, this is something we're tracking very closely at Foursquare as well, because it's very important for our apps. But what happens is, if you want an app to use location in the background when the app is not being used, it not only asks permission when you first install the app, but then it waits a couple days and it says, hey, this app is using your location in the background. Are you sure you want this? And then people have to click OK again. And I understand why they're doing this. They don't want apps having location backgrounds on when the apps don't need it. But I do question whether this is the right way to, this is the right solution here to get more notifications, more, you know, hey, are you okay with cookies? Whoever says they're not okay with cookies, just give me the information. You know, and so I don't know. I feel like we have to kind of outsource mentally outsource these apps are, you're getting value from it, from having location in the background, versus these apps you're not. I don't think it's enough just to bombard us with more notifications when in all likelihood we're trying to accomplish something else with our phone.
Yeah, I don't think it's risen quite to the level of this other issue, but some Windows users might remember with Windows Vista that the user access control feature was introduced. Which basically meant that anytime you were going to do something that might change system settings or basically anything that would require admin control, because most Windows users didn't have a separate admin account at that point, it would pop up there would be a pop-up interface that would ask you, do you really want to grant this level of control to whatever the application was trying to do it? And you may have even had to put in your password again to allow that. And it was constantly spamming users to the point where it became super annoying. And they eventually walked that back a little bit and made it more tolerable. But that's the risk you run with providing too much user information in this fashion.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that, because people do need to track their access controls. But on the other hand, it's always, you know, you're always pushing it on people at the wrong time, and there's no one's had a good interface for that. Nobody wants to control their access controls. I feel like we need to have some trusted, we need to outsource it to some trusted place other than the developers themselves who are going to take advantage.
Yeah, well, and I can see why a lot of developers that do use these features aren't liking it, because it almost presents them to the user as this app is doing something wrong and they're bad, and you should really reconsider allowing them to do that.
Yeah, I mean, well, the app that I'm working on at Foursquare Labs is going to use background location. It's very clear why we're doing it. It's sort of a pretty fun thing. And I'll probably have a whole show on that in the future, but we'll see what, I'm not too concerned about it. I think the people who want the app want the background location on. But, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I would say that the apps I've noticed primarily triggering this have been Foursquare related apps and Google Maps. Those are the two families that I remember seeing those notifications from.
Okay, well, that's good because those are ones that should be using background location. If you see
or at least it's understandable why. It's not like right. It's a flashlight app that's phoning home and telling the developer where I am all the time.
Well, maybe that's not why you're not getting those anymore, because maybe that feature has prevented those kind of rogue apps from asking for these permissions.
Yeah. Well, and I don't use Apple Maps, but I would be curious, would Apple Maps also produce this kind of an alert or a warning? Or because it's an Apple product, it's not subject to that level of scrutiny. It gets a pass.
Good question. Good question. I don't know the answer to that. I would guess they get a pass. Okay, so let's move on to the Venezuela story real quick here. When I searched for news on this story, it kept bringing me to a site called dnyuz.com, and it's impossible to tell what that site is. Fortunately, it looks like their articles are actually articles from the New York Times and other places that we know. But it's really, I was like, is this a fake news site? I couldn't even tell.
Yeah, it's tough to do the due diligence when you can't even find out any information about the news source itself. But like you said,
okay.
It all seems to lead back to the New York Times. So they're at least a known quantity.
Yeah. Right. As I think I said on the notes here. Okay, so at least we're not relying on this random site that I don't know who it is. We can instead rely on the failing and lying New York Times. This story is, I don't know how much... How do I put this?
Let's lay out the thesis here before we get too worked up about it.
Okay, no, I just want to say that it's hard for me to tell whether this story is going to be important in the long run or not, or whether it's kind of a one-off thing and the Venezuelan government really isn't serious about this. But apparently what's happening now, Venezuela has gone deeper and deeper into the abyss of socialism, command economy, over the years, and there have been some very negative impacts on the people. You know, there have been food shortages, toilet paper shortages, electricity shortages. Their money no longer works. And so eventually their government has been backed so far into a corner now, it looks like they're finally allowing a modicum of freedom that will provide some relief to people. So one of these things is, first of all, allowing people to use U.S. dollars. They were using U.S. dollars before, but it was illegal, and the Venezuelan Bolivar didn't work. But at least now, if they're going to kind of turn the other way, if you could use U.S. dollars, which is weird because you're using the enemy country's currency, but they're just going to use U.S. dollars, and so that's going to help people out a lot, I think. Another one is allowing some foreign investment into their oil company. Not allowing foreign companies to come in and compete with like products and services and stuff, but allowing a little bit of foreign investment, which will allow some wealth and capital to flow into Venezuela, which will help some people.
Yeah, and I think particularly...
Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah. A couple of thoughts on the oil front. I think a big part of it is the state-run oil company has not only is it being run in a socialist command economy approach, but it is rampant with nepotism and corruption and all sorts of structural problems that even if it was in a capitalist society where all these other issues were not part of it, this would not be a successful leading company. And so bringing in,
I mean, but that's what always happens in socialism, because there's no check on any of this stuff.
Yeah, well, so bringing in Exxon or was it ExxonMobil or Chevron or companies like that, and having them basically operate the oil fields and Venezuela gets to skim off a percentage of that, means that A, the fields are actually operating, that the outputs in the last several years have plummeted, and B, that as a result they're making more money taking a cut from these foreign companies than they were running it all by themselves. So it's going to work out for them in that sense. It's the only logical market approach to the problem. So removing some of the false limitations there is benefiting everybody. But the other thing I wanted to mention was that there were a couple of parallels drawn in the article to Cuba and China. And you've been to Cuba, so do they allow and or encourage the use of U.S. dollars there, or are you required to put everything into the local currency?
Oh, so it's even more interesting than that, Aaron. They have two local currencies, and
I remember you telling me something about that.
Yes, one local currency is for the locals, and another currency that they have is for the tourists. And what do you know? It's 1-to-1 exchange rate with the dollar.
Okay,
but
so that's
you can't use
their way
actual
of
dollars
controlling
they don't
it,
want to admit.
But yeah. Functionally giving dollar parity.
Yeah.
So, because I was gonna say it. I don't think even Cuba was just letting the dollar float freely in their economy. That they wouldn't be cool with that. But
no.
But yeah, the other parallel being China in the sense that yes, it's a communist government, but they have allowed some limited entrepreneurship and capitalist pseudo free market ventures, largely in collaboration with state run enterprise.
Sure, and probably
so
I
perhaps
mean,
that's I, the direction this is moving, but it's really
the impression
tough to tell
I get is that they in the 80s and 90s they did a lot more opening up, possibly even more than Venezuela is doing now. Now I heard it might be going the opposite direction, but that's just what I heard. I could be wrong about that. I did one phrase irked me in this article, which is the new free market economy, which I'm like, yeah, the free market economy, just because you go from 0% to 1%, that just sounds crazy to me. You're like a communist dictatorship, but we're going to allow like one or two market-based things to happen that the government is still closely watching. How could you call that the new free market economy? I guess they use words differently than I do.
My take on it is that the Maduro was looking at a full-on starvation crisis, and if they hadn't done something to get goods into the country, he was going to be overthrown by rioting mobs.
Right.
And so they've more or less kind of sold out to the upper class, and they're letting the rich people in Caracas, bring in foreign goods and spend U.S. dollars, and that keeps peace in the capital. And so what if the people out in the countryside still don't have electricity and don't have food? They're out in the countryside. They can't lynch me in the capital. So it'll be interesting to see if that's enough to maintain his grip on power and stability.
But it's amazing. Like, things were getting so bad there even 5 years ago that it took them this long to do something about it. Like, maybe 5 years ago, yeah, people were starving, but they're like, our government can stay. We could still fight this out. It's only until things had to get so bad for so long in order for this to happen. And I understand that some people in his government are still opposed to this. They think that it is a stab in the back to the socialist revolution.
Yeah, well, and what's not entirely
the
clear
Chavez.
To me is so Venezuela has had this it's not a government in exile, but they've had there's the Maduro government, and there is the Juan Guaido government.
He was at the State of the Union.
Yeah, so
it's unbelievable. And he was introduced as the real president of Venezuela. Like,
so we support Guaido, and I think a number of European countries do as well. However, I think him and his party or his administration might actually be opposed to some of these changes, because they might be more closely aligned with a traditional Chavist approach here.
Sometimes there are no good
for different reasons, but yeah, it there may be a little bit of an inversion of priorities here, because when you get desperate, you'll do anything to hold on to power.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on this, or are we ready to go? I think.
I did want to mention one thing. There was another article you shared that was talking about immigration and the return, saying that many Venezuelans are returning back to Venezuela after they'd fled to other countries because things aren't so bad anymore and things were actually pretty tough elsewhere. And I take issue with
it sounds hard to believe that things could turn around that fast.
Well, yeah, there's certainly that. I think so. One of my pet peeves is when we talk about in the U.S., the Congress talks about budget cuts. And in most cases, what they're doing are not actually budget cuts. It's that they're increasing the budget by less than was originally planned. So
yeah.
They're still increasing spending, but not by as much. That's not a budget cut. So what we're seeing here is it's not that that people are no longer leaving Venezuela and they're returning to Venezuela. It's that the rate of people fleeing the country is decreasing. And perhaps the rate of people returning to the country is increasing, but we're still looking at overall a massive net exodus. They quoted something that, what was it? 17 in the last 5 years, 17% of those who left, which equates to about 1 million people, have returned. That being said, in 2020, the projection is that 6 million are going to flee Venezuela. So if you take the number of people who've returned in the last 5 years and compare it to the number of people that are going to leave this year, you're still at a net loss of 5 million people in a country that I believe last year had a 30 million population. So they're still draining people. It's pretty insincere to say that, oh yeah, the embrace of capitalism is causing immigrants to return and you know, problem solved, everything's getting better. Things may be there may be an inflection point here, but we're not at the bottom of the curve. We haven't hit rock bottom and started to climb back out yet.
I mean, that's scary for a number of reasons. I mean, you know, when a country's been run into the ground this long, I mean, imagine if something like coronavirus were to outbreak there, there'd be very little you could do to stop it. And so, a natural disaster, a hurricane, things like that. It's just, it's a very scary situation. So hopefully things do turn around. Venezuela, how much do you want to bet Venezuela comes up in the presidential election this year?
I would not at all be surprised by that.
Yeah, because Bernie Sanders and frankly, a lot of the Democrats, but not all of them, were supporting the government of Venezuela as it was rising.
Well, yeah, particularly if Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee, Trump is going to hammer on him about, oh, why are you a socialist? Look at Venezuela. And whether or not that's fair, it would be a talking point.
Right. Well, then he'll say, like, I'm not talking about Venezuela. But then it's like, well, you were supporting Venezuela then, and now you have nothing to say about it. I just think, you know, you should have something to say about it. But he doesn't, as far as I know.
Well, stepping away from the politics of the matter and circling back to something you mentioned earlier, we've talked in the past about Bitcoin in Venezuela and how, given the economic situation there, it was becoming an attractive option for a lot of people. I'd be curious to see what the numbers look like for Bitcoin usage in Venezuela now that U.S. dollars are more or less freely flowing there. I would imagine that takes a lot of the pressure off Bitcoin, that because there's comparatively more friction to convert money in and out of Bitcoin into something usable down there, that if it's easier to get a hold of dollars, they'll just go with that instead. So I'd be curious to see any data to back up my suspicion on that.
Yeah, it would be. It's going to be a while before before you can get the data on this. It could be right. The people who got into it might still be into it. There are some reports that the government is using it to get around sanctions. So that's an interesting use case.
There was a little bit in there about. Because there are sanctions on Venezuelan oil, that they're, I didn't see the Bitcoin part about it, but that definitely that they're trying to kind of whitewash their oil exports to make it look like it's not coming from there so they can sell it elsewhere.
Yeah. So, okay, you have PDVSA, that's the name of the oil company there?
Yes.
Okay, cool. And what is their relationship with Chevron?
So there are a bunch of different oil companies, but basically they've licensed them to go operate certain oil fields.
Gotcha.
And they're bringing up production rates significantly, and the Venezuelan government gets a cut of that, but they don't own the entire process. It's not necessarily there. So I think not only was the oil industry being run entirely through this PDVSA company, the biggest industry in Venezuela for decades. I think it was also the biggest employer in Venezuela for that.
That
period.
Makes sense.
So that has changed, and I'm sure some of those employees are now working for Chevron and ExxonMobil and such. But it's a very different scenario when your employer is the government versus when your employer is a company that has a government contract.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Looks like we did okay on time. We've got a cool hour and I think we're ready to head out. We've got a lot of topics just between the two of us that we could do on co-hosted shows in the bag. So I'm looking forward to that. I have a lot of guests in the pipeline, but I don't have anything recorded, so I don't want to jinx anything. But I've got some pretty interesting guests in the pipeline, and I'm hoping to get a few more. So looking forward to
awesome.
That. Any last thoughts on all this stuff?
Well, yeah. So I just wanted to throw out, I mentioned it in passing earlier in the episode, but I recently listened to episode 105 with Sophie Carr. As a fellow aeronautical engineer, I thought that was a fascinating interview with her, and I just wanted to say I really enjoyed that. And I know we've talked about you doing an interview on my backstory at some point in the future. We haven't gotten around to that yet.
But you snuck out of that, haven't you? Okay. Yeah. I knew that was your background, and I thought that. I'm glad you like that. She does have some, I don't know if you saw some of her YouTube videos online.
I went through the ones you linked. Those were pretty interesting.
Yeah, those are very good. That's become a very popular episode. So Bayesian stuff is, and math stuff is more popular than people would have you believe.
Well, maybe we need to update our priors about that.
Yeah. All right. I think that's it, Aaron. Take care and have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxSklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.